It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
Pardon me, Mr. Vasily, this is your score, Doris. I've got all the cues marked in, I think. You come in right after the fourth beat there, okay?
Okay, Frank.
Let's give it a lot of personality now.
All right, ready, everybody.
Casey Jr. I used to know his old man.
All right, boys, let's go for a rehearsal. Lights. Picture.
Let's go. One, two, three, four.
All aboard. All aboard.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Jaws? I'm Paul Spitero, and as is always my pleasure, I am joined by my good buddy, Mr. Sean Whalen.
It's a pleasure to be here, buddy.
It's a pleasure to be here with you, and we are joined by our buddy, Mr. Scott H. Gardner, and by H, what's an H word that means you're always there?
I'll have to think about it.
I keep going back to hermaphrodite, but I know that's not right. Anyway, Scott is probably our most present guest, but there's a reason for that, because he's one of the few people who's willing to come on this often. we are continuing our journey through the feature-length Disney films, and the next one in line is the 1941 film The Reluctant Dragon. And if you listened to the end of our Fantasia discussion, we were kind of on the fence as to whether or not we were going to do The Reluctant Dragon. And I'll be quite honest, I did not know this movie by name at all. When it came up, I was like, I pictured an entire movie about this dragon, just an animated feature, you know, about the dragon. I did not know what it's about. I just watched it this week. It's the first time that I watched it that I can specifically say I recall watching it this week when I saw it. But some of it felt very familiar. So I'm thinking I may have seen bits of it on The Wonderful World of Disney as I was growing up. I'm not sure about that. I tried to do an internet search to see broadcast television, you know, times that it was on broadcast television, and I could not find anything from those years. I did find later that it was on, you know, the Disney Channel, but I did not find it on ABC on The Wonderful World of Disney. But I think it may have been, again, in clips as opposed to the entire film from beginning to end, because it did have a sense of familiarity to me. So I'm thinking I may have seen bits. But otherwise, this is the first time I've ever sat and watched it from beginning to end. I found it very interesting, actually, just because for exactly the reasons I'm sure that they put it together to give you the background of the studio and try and make it more accessible to people and make it more interesting to people, and yet still have some animated parts in there for kids to, you know, to engage them. So I found it very interesting. But this, again, my first time ever watching this. How about you guys?
So I'm kind of in the same boat you are. I was sure I'd seen it. And what I think I'm sure I've seen before is at least clips of Reluctant Dragon, the actual short. The rest of it, I've seen, I think, the Goofy short before. I'm a very huge Goofy fan. And I think I will say this, for personally, we would have made a huge mistake skipping this one. I think there's a lot of historical reason why we should talk about this one, because a lot of firsts happen on this one that I think are interesting, being first the Goofy short. The fact that this was the kickoff of the how-to series, which Goofy's so well known for, I didn't realize it was here. So I'm personally glad we're doing this one and appreciate the thought process of let's give it a shot, because I sworn I'd seen it. I haven't. The Reluctant Dragon, I remember the dragon, I remember Sir Giles, but I don't know, did I see the whole thing or not? I don't know, and I think you're asking some really good questions about broadcast history as far as this goes. This is an unusual one for me to miss. I love older Disney films. I love the deep dives into the company's history and kind of how the studio innovated and stuff like that. And there's so much out of this, I think it's going to be a fun discussion, because I do not think I've seen this before in its entirety. And I'm glad that I got a chance to.
Yeah, I'm not sure when I first saw this, but it had to be relatively recent. And by relatively recent, I mean, you know, in the 20-something years since I became a diehard Disney fan. But I don't recall exactly when I saw it for the first time. I think interesting is the key word in describing this movie, at least for me, because it's kind of all over the place. It's several movies in one. This is basically a package feature before that became really a thing. And by package feature, you know, we'll talk more about that later, but, you know, package features are something that Walt eventually had to go to because of several, you know, things that were going on real world, to where it was basically shorts all packaged together and then sold as a motion picture. And that's kind of what this movie is. So similar to our discussion of Fantasia, I think we'll probably end up talking about the individual segments, and how they all, you know, link together or don't. As the case may be. As far as the broadcast history, I wish I don't have the capacity at the moment, with everything that's plugged into my computer, to switch to another drive, but I have another drive that has most of the Disneyland and Wonderful World of Color stuff on it. And I'm curious, if I went through that, if I could find where these segments, or maybe the movie as a whole, was broadcast as part of that on network television, but I don't know. I'm almost positive, though, that at the very least, the Reluctant Dragon animated sequence itself was out at least on VHS. I'm almost positive, because I remember the cover. I remember it being like a sky blue cover with a picture of the dragon. That's kind of how I knew who the character was, even before I actually had seen the movie in total. But you know, I've since watched it a few times, and yeah, we'll talk about it, because it is an interesting piece of Disney history.
It is just for by way of background. And if you haven't seen the set, maybe you want to see it. But, you know, maybe you want to sit down and watch it. It's on Disney Plus. Maybe you want to pause this, see it, and then listen to our discussion because it'll probably give it a little bit more context. But the whole film, it definitely, like I said, it wasn't what I anticipated. I anticipated just an animated feature. It starts off, it's a combination of live action and animated, and the framing sequences are around Robert Benchley, who has the book, The Reluctant Dragon, and he is pushed by his wife to bring it to the Disney studios to present it to Walt Disney to create an animated feature. And he's reluctant. He's the reluctant dragon seller. So he goes to the Disney studio, and throughout the course of time, he's trying to evade the handler who was sent to bring him to Walt. And he does kind of a tour of the animation studios, the Foley area, where they put the pictures to create a cartoon, and eventually sees the movie The Reluctant Dragon, which apparently got produced in the time it took him to avoid Walt up until that point. And that's kind of it. So it's really a framing sequence with a bunch of things in there, but the bunch of things serve to not only entertain you, but to show you how these cartoons are put together and how complicated it is to put everything together. Some of it seems a little forced, let me say, as far as, you know, the realism of it.
But staged.
It still kind of gives you, but even beyond staged, because I think when they get to the Foley sequence and they're doing the train, I think they do it a little too cleanly, too quickly, you know, all in one take. I suspect that when they would do something like that, they'd be adding pieces bit by bit, not doing it all at once as a performance. So, you know, that's kind of the impression I got, that this is all staged to simplify, but to give you an idea of what goes into it.
There's actually some other reasons why it is staged. There was a artist strike going on at the time, which some of the artists were actually on strike. And some of them were chosen to be, and there were some of them that were actors portraying artists. Some of them were the genuine Disney artists, like Ward Kimball's in it, which is really cool. You know, so, I mean, for those that are Disney fans and like, you know, some of the old Disney history, there are actual Disney artists in it. But in some cases, this idea of the bullpen was not what was going on at the time. You had a split because you had some of the people on strike. So I think you saying that this felt somewhat staged is actually more accurate than maybe would be intended. But I did like the fact that our main protagonist in this was nervous to meet Walt. That was like his reason. Then he all of a sudden gets captivated by the Disney magic as far as like how it was going on behind the scenes. I do like that part of it. It's charming. While some of it, I agree with you, seems staged, I'm like sitting here going, okay, I'd be geeking out and doing this too. Anything I can do to get into one other room just to see how all of this goes together. I think that part, I'll admit, it hit some of the kid in me in a way that I wasn't expecting. I was expecting this was going to be an interesting film to do because I was going to feel like it somehow was a lesser film. I think Scott's point about this being an interesting film is could not be more accurate. It's very different than anything else that we're going to cover in the fact that it was the first of its kind for Disney. And I think some of the sequences in here, some of them work better than others, I got to admit that I did like our main protagonist. I found like he was charming. I found he was fun. He was silly at times, but not too over the top, because there was a danger of skirting the lines where this becomes constant slapstick and any form of coherent story kind of gets lost. And it didn't. As we kind of progress through it, there's one thing I would have done differently. And it's at the very end of the film, and I'll talk about that maybe as we get a little bit closer to that. But other than that, I was enjoying the journey with him. I liked him, and I think that's critical on this. If you're going to use a guy like this and he's not likable, we've got a big problem here. So I did like hanging out with him during the film and him being our kind of eyesight into the world of Disney that they were trying to craft here for us.
Yeah, he was a charming. I mean, he was a lovable guy. He really was. And I like that because I have no familiarity with this guy other than this movie. I mean, I understand he was a big deal in his day, but I have no idea who he is. I know him from this, and I know that he's apparently the grandfather of Peter Benchley, who wrote Jaws. So there you go. I did have
a connection to the show.
Exactly. I did have a question for you, Paul. You said you watched this on Disney Plus, and I'm very curious, was there any disclaimer before the movie?
No.
I'm curious. Okay, so that makes me wonder.
What would it have been?
Well, it makes me wonder if the one that's on Disney Plus is actually complete or if it's edited, if there's no disclaimer, because they apparently, unless they've gone in and done something about their disclaimers, because I know that a lot of people were complaining about them. But on a lot of the older stuff, a lot of the Walt stuff, which is, I think, the point of contention for a lot of people, Disney Plus was putting disclaimer warnings on there about, you know, how this is old and it's dated and, you know, there may be things in there that'll, you know, offend snowflakes type of thing. And there are a couple of things in this that by today's standards might be pushing those boundaries a little bit. The big one I can think of off the top of my head is there's a sequence. I'm trying to remember if it's a drawing or if it's a maquette or maybe both of. I know what it is. It's the one that really stood out to me is it's during the baby Weems sequence when the news is traveling around the world. I think it's when the baby gets sick. And the news is going around the world. And at one point it shows natives of some, you know, far off land and drawn very, I guess you would just say culturally insensitively. And I'm wondering if that was in the version that you saw. Because it was like the stereotypical, like, I don't know what it's meant to be, like a headhunter or, you know, just like some primitive tribe, but, you know, with the neck ring thing where the neck is elongated and like the big like plates in the lips and that sort of thing. And it just, you know, a very, you know, racially insensitive depiction essentially. So I'm curious if that's in the one that's currently playing on Disney Plus or not. Do you recall seeing that?
I don't. I don't recall any disclaimer either though.
Right.
So maybe it just got cut out, and that's why they don't have a disclaimer.
Right. That's kind of what I'm thinking.
But it's also possible that I missed it.
Right. I mean, there's a couple other little things. There's also the fact that he seems to really be kind of hitting on the girl that's touring him around at one point, and I don't know how that would fly by modern standard. You know, just some of the little comments. I mean, They're basically harmless, but, you know, with today's very sensitive culture and all, it could be seen as some form of like sexual harassment, I guess. So I was just curious how, you know, how that was flying on Disney Plus or not. I'm kind of surprised this one's on there, to be honest with you, but I'm glad that it is.
It's interesting that you talk
to me as slightly, you know, slightly flirtatious, but it didn't really feel like it was over the top.
Right.
This was a film that had some censorship to it, though. Their original version that they put together, they had to actually reshoot. I'm jokingly got my name as In Search of the Dragon's Navel, but they actually, the first version of the drawing of the dragon apparently had a navel on it. And the Hays office objected to that. So they had to take the dragon's navel out. I don't know. I didn't see any reference to what other cuts, but there was multiple things they at least had to go back in. The one that they note is the dragon's navel was removed. So
wow.
Thank goodness we have a navel-free dragon in this.
Well, given my druthers, I'll take Barbara Eden's navel over this one anyway. Because that was always the controversy about I Dream of Jeannie, was that they couldn't show her navel. So do we want to take a look at the sequences, I guess? So the movie, I guess, you know, start with the opening sequence with Benchley at home playing around in the pool, shooting at the little ducks, and his wife you know, excuse me for being insensitive, but his wife nagging him. Because that's really what she's doing, about how he's got to go and take this book to sell it to Walt. You know, I mean, it's a minor thing, but I thought it did present a good kind of a framing sequence to kind of let us know where we're going from there.
Yeah.
And then, unless you have any comments on that. Okay, go ahead.
No, it was kind of the foil. It was kind of the foil for the opening bit. And I actually, that's the part like I'd like to see at the end, some circling back to, because at the end, she kind of goes to him, na, 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 you know, and I was kind of hoping there would be a bit where they'd circle back and kind of go, hey, I'd given it to Walt and I was trying to surprise you or something like that. You know, it would have been a nice ending of this piece that, like, because the premise of the fact that during this film, they somehow crafted a whole animated short. I would have liked it more if they had just said, hey, did you like the movie that we ended up surprising you with? Because this book was such a good idea and didn't really come together like that.
I wonder, is that
woman? Yeah, it did seem a little convoluted.
Is that woman really his wife? I was trying to find that, and I could not find it anywhere. I couldn't find like a, you know, much of a credits list or anything.
So,
you know, as far as
Nana Bryant played her, and she was Mrs. Benchley. So,
okay.
So I'm assuming that was meant to be his wife.
It's meant to be his wife, but I don't know. I don't think it really is his wife.
Yeah, no, not according to her.
His actress wife.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, not according to her Wikipedia. Yeah, so she was just an actress then. Okay. All right. Interesting.
So the first sequence in Disney Studios is the life drawing class where the animators are, basically there's a live elephant in the room and they're, well, it almost sounds like a cliche, doesn't it? There's a live elephant in the room and they're trying to create caricatures that bring personality and to a cartoon image of the creature. Now, this feels a little forced to me, like that I don't see it as reality. Now, I would imagine in reality they did use real models to try and create or photos or whatever of live animals to kind of come up with their character models. But I don't imagine that they brought an elephant in and sat it down and had a bunch of artists trying to create those images the way they did, or at least certainly not as quickly as they were doing it. You know, I think it's more, I would think if anything, you would first learn how to draw a real lifelike elephant and then from that, take it to the point where you draw a caricature.
They were known for doing that though. As far I know with Bambi and stuff like that, I'm with you as far as timing on this. I geeked out at the sequence. I'm with you. I don't think that that's like, this was shot live. Like this is them putting together Dumbo, but I geeked out that we got to see some early shots of Dumbo, early shots of Bambi in this because of the studio tour. And I think that was meant to replicate something that they do. And I agree with you, that's probably a far more complicated process that they were doing at that time. But at least in some of the, because I've got a lot of those tins, the Disney Classics tins.
Yes.
With a lot of the extra features. And you'll see shots of them using real animals as, especially for like Snow White and for things like that, to get some of the animation right. So it's, I don't think it was uncommon for them. To do it. But this was, again, you mentioned staged earlier. I think a lot of this, when we go through them, was definitely a stage sequence. A lot, it was obviously meant to be the foil for our Mr. Benchley kind of sneaking in to hopefully see the pretty girl that he was following in there. That was, and to all of a sudden be disappointed because he's seeing a giant elephant. But, you know, it was meant to be a joke more than anything else. I did geek out at the Dumbo references. I thought that was kind of cool to show, like, hey, this would have been neat to be in the theater early on going, is that something we're going to see in the future? Because context-wise, it predates all of that, which is really cool. It was later this year, that same year, that Dumbo comes out. So this would have been for moviegoers their first chance to see some shots of Dumbo, perhaps.
And they probably could have done a better job of, maybe without making it so, so obvious like I'm going to now, but maybe say, you know, here's a character that we're working on for our next feature, you know, that kind of thing, so that people watching this, especially young kids, are going to see it and become a little bit more excited or interested in, wow, I want to see what they do with this. So I think that's a marketing thing more than a filmmaking thing. But I think that, you know, the whole purpose of this was to make the whole process more understandable to the audience in general. I was going to say children, but not really. I think it's the whole audience. I think getting them ramped up and excited about what's to come should be part of that. And it would make it more interesting for the viewer, saying, I'm going to see where this is going to go to. And that's going to make me want to pay attention now more, because because I'm going to see where this is going to go. And when I do see that, I'm going to want to say, hey, I saw that before and I recognize that and I'm familiar with that. So I think that would have made it a little bit more interesting, I think, to let the people know these are characters that are coming up in a feature soon.
Well, I mean, I agree with you. It does feel like a missed opportunity or something that could have been exploited a little bit more. But two things that occur to me is that, for one, I think he was also probably aware that he was opening himself up to great criticism. Because already the picture kind of feels like a commercial. It's kind of like an infomercial in a lot of ways, you know, with the studio tour and all that sort of thing. So he was probably very aware of the potential of that criticism. Plus, also, it's kind of fortuitous that maybe he didn't linger over different things and be like, and this is, you know, we're working on this, this is coming next year, and this is coming the year after, and then this one, and then this one. Because it's blink and you miss it, but when they're in the maquette studio and Benchley walks along and he's looking at all the different figures, it's one of those things you have to consciously think about, because you see like Mr. Darling, for example, and you see some different characters that are, they were in production. They were working on this stuff. So they were doing preliminaries for things like Lady and the Tramp, Peter Pan. I forget, there's a couple other ones too. I didn't make a note of them. Those would not be realized for over a decade later in some cases. So maybe it's a good thing he didn't linger over them and be like, hey, we're working on Peter Pan, because then if people got excited about it, they'd be doing nothing but going, hey, where's Peter Pan for the next 10 years? You know, so.
Which is a common thing that happens today, actually. Right. Sometimes we get stuff revealed way too early, and just because of production delays and things like that, it becomes actually a negative for the film, because people can tend to get worn out and oversaturated with something beforehand, and sometimes it doesn't deliver to the hype, and
right.
It winds up being a negative for the film. So he was,
he
was kind of cutting edge, I think, in the sense of maybe having a better pulse on how to handle some of that stuff.
Right.
Because it is an infomercial, but, he put a fence around it, especially with this being so early in them. There's a lot of things where people maybe can look back and kind of go, he was a little more tactful with this than we are today. Maybe we should follow him.
Right. See, I'm very curious now about the Disney Plus version of this, because it occurs to me that in that elephant sequence, when he walks over to the Asian animator that's doing the sketch, when he sees the elephant style that she's drawing, he says, oh, a coolie elephant. Coolie, I think, today is considered an offensive or semi-offensive term, I think. I don't profess to know these things, but I can't quite see that term flying today. So again, I'm curious if that's included in the Disney Plus version, or if they censored it out or not. But, you know, just things like that. And I think he says something to her as they part company too, that I'm not sure would fly with today's censors. So
I think they did leave that in, by the way. I wasn't paying attention for the purpose of seeing that, but I seem to remember him saying that. So from the drawing class, he goes to the film score and voice recording session, and we have Clarence Nash there, who's the voice of Donald Duck and much beloved, and we have Florence Gill, who's the voice of Clara Cluck, who I personally could do without.
I did like...
I found her to be irritating, to be honest with you.
So I'm 1,000% with you, but here's where it worked for me. On an isolation, if it was just her, it would have been as annoying as you're saying. I think when Donald entered into it, it was kind of like he was refreshing, if that makes... Like, Donald saved the day. I was like, oh, okay, this is what they're doing with that as an interesting point for... you know, Donald to go in. I did feel like having Donald come into it made the whole sequence better for me. But that's, again, I'm showing my biases toward, I'm a big Donald Duck geek. So I think he can save any sequence. And I actually really liked seeing Clarence Nash. But I'm with you. She was annoying and not what I was expecting because the music was playing. I was not expecting this. I should have because of the nature of the film. I should have expected that this was going to be leading into some form of voiceover work. I thought this was just demonstrating music being used in the course of animation. So she was a shocking surprise, which I liked at first, but she went on too long until Donald came in and saved the day.
Yeah, that sequence runs way too long. It's fascinating to, you know, in that, you know, finding out how the sausage is made kind of way, fascinating, because I've actually seen whatever cartoon that is. I have no idea what cartoon that winds up in, but it does wind up in a cartoon. Mm-hmm. And I've seen the cartoon, and it's one of those things that, you know, you don't really think about when you're watching the cartoon is, you know, who does that? You know, I mean, I'm sure people wondered about Donald Duck and Mickey Mouse, you know, the major characters, who does the voice and that sort of thing, and how do they do it? But like Clara, who really thought about how do they do, you know, Clara Cluck making that? And it was just kind of fascinating to see that woman, you know, give that voice. But that said, you know, didn't need to do more than like 30 seconds to a minute of it. And I don't know how long that sequence goes on, but it felt like an eternity. And it went on so long that I ended up muting through that sequence because I was not alone in the house. I'm upstairs watching the movie in the theater room and became very cognizant of there's this really annoying bawk, bawk, bawk going on upstairs. I didn't want my wife to holler like, what in the hell are you watching up there? You know, that sort of thing. So, but it is interesting. And
I watched this with headphones on, and I'm glad in hindsight that I did for exactly the reason that you just said.
I'm pretty sure they still use that voice work for Clara to this day. I wouldn't be surprised at all if Clara appears in one of the parades at Walt Disney World. I want to say it's the, I think it's one of the floats for the Halloween, you know, Mickey's Not So Scary Halloween Party. And I think it's the same voice work. I could be wrong about that, but it sounds the same to me.
You know, it's,
it,
you know,
it could well be.
I found something interesting. I'm looking at the IMDb trivia sequence. Uh-huh. I looked at actually a couple different trivias. You were asking about the Disney Plus warning, and this does allude to a Disney Plus warning. They may have removed it now, but there was a warning at the beginning about racial stereotypes.
Interesting.
So at some point in time, it was there, at least IMDb's referencing the fact that it was there. At some point in time,
possible that it was there and I missed it.
Yeah, I'm just throwing it out because the question came up as far as is there a warning there, and I at least at some point there was one.
Right.
Whether it's still there or not, I just think it's interesting.
Yeah, I can't definitively tell you it wasn't there, but I did. I don't recall seeing. Now, just to be fair here, I watched this the other night. In the middle of the night because I was having trouble sleeping. And I got up and I was like, I got to watch something. So that's why I was watching it with headphones. I didn't want to wake the rest of the house. So it's possible just, you know, based on when I was watching it that could have just escaped my view. I read
in part of the trivia too that Walt was trying to shoot for a certain runtime for this, so they had to go back to the drawing board a couple of times in order to get that length. I'm wondering if that led to some of this perception. I mean, because I think we all have it, this perception that some things went on just a little bit too long. Whereas I think in editing, if you're trying to clean up, I would have cut down some of that musical number in order to make it a little bit more pleasing. But it wasn't a bad sequence to me, but I'm wondering if that runtime thing became a thing.
Well, I'm wondering what, you know, either in Walt's mind or in some official or semi-official way, what constitutes a feature versus a short? Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking 70-ish minutes has to be that magical number, because this runs, I think, 74 minutes, something like that. Dumbo only runs, I think Dumbo runs exactly 70, if I'm not mistaken. So, you know, there's that fine line there, I agree. They totally needed to cut down that sequence. But if they did, then it might have brought the film under whatever running time it needed to be to qualify as a feature film.
Yeah. This is also the first movie where the voices are credited. I didn't realize that. It's the first full-length feature where Disney credited the voices.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I didn't catch that. Yeah, that's right at the beginning, too. I like that title sequence at the beginning. There's a lot of famous names in that as that goes by. It went by a little fast for me because I meant to make note of who scored the film, and I missed it initially, but I'm wondering if this ever got any sort of official or even an unofficial release, because I really enjoyed the music in the Benchley sequence at the beginning. A lot of it's just recycling, the popular songs from Snow White, but well done. I mean, you know, masterfully used. I really enjoyed that stuff. It was, you know, it would make nice, you know, just pleasant listening music type of thing.
So the next sequence, and I think it fits what we were talking about being a little staged, but I did find to be very interesting to watch, was a Foley session for the cartoon Dumbo, which just by way of release, Dumbo came out 4 months after this movie. So there is an element of, hey, this is something we're going to be coming out with. And if you took your kid, I'm thinking if you took like a 6-year-old to see this, there were probably points where they were bored. But during the animated sequences, I would think they'd perk up. And then if you took your 6-year-old 4 months later to see Dumbo and they see, hey, I remember that sequence, I think there would be some excitement from that. So even without saying this is coming up soon, I do think there is an element of commercialization here. But I found this sequence to be pretty interesting. Again, I'm not sure about the accuracy of how it's done. I think it's a much more complex process than what they show here, but I do think they give you just a general idea of what they have to do to create the sounds that you hear, and how what you hear is not just them recreating what's going on in the screen. Sometimes they're using something that's totally different than what's on the screen to create the illusion of that sound. And I've always found Foley artists to be fascinating, to be honest.
Yeah. This is one of my favorite sequences because, you know, watching them when Casey Jr.'s wheels start to turn, you know, and Casey Jr.'s a train and the wheels start to turn and it starts to build up to what we all think of as train sounds. I'm watching this sequence and I'm just fascinated thinking, wouldn't it be easier to just go out and record a train? But they, you know, either that wasn't a practical thing for them or, you know, it really showcases their mastery and their artistry when, you know, in that studio, they can totally recreate the sound of, a locomotive and it's completely believable. And most of the stuff they were using for that seemed to be pretty basic, low-tech stuff. That's fascinating to me. Yeah. I've always been fascinated by sound, you know, engineers and that sort of thing. You know, I loved watching you know, the old documentaries when I was a kid for the Star Wars films. And, you know, Ben Burtt was my hero, you know, that guy, you know, creating all the, you know, everything from laser sounds to the, you know, using a, what was it, a sheet metal cutter as the sound of the AT-AT footsteps. I love stuff like that. So yeah, this was neat to see the Foleys, you know, doing their thing. One quick thing though, on the Casey Jr. that always stands out to me is this is a beautifully animated sequence. And I'm wondering, where did it wind up, or was it just for this movie? Because while Casey Jr. is a character in Dumbo, this sequence is not in Dumbo. So I'm curious, you know, what the whole story is with this specific piece of animation.
And my guess is that this was created potentially for the movie Dumbo, but by the time this was put together, they had already determined it was going to be an outtake, and they decided to use it for promotional purposes in this movie.
Right.
That would be my guess. I don't have any knowledge other than our conversation.
Even in the trivia section, they referenced the fact that during the sound effects segment, they show a clip of Casey Jr., which later appeared in a much shorter version for Dumbo.
Right.
So I'm wondering if this was their first test run and kind of...
Could be. Because the two things that stand out to me are when he sinks the boat, which I'm almost positive is not in Dumbo, and then the crash at the end, which definitely is not in Dumbo. So, yeah. What else you got, Paul?
And continuing to move on, our next sequence is the camera room, which features a demonstration of the multiplane camera. And at this point, a la The Wizard of Oz, we go from black and white to color. And honestly, I found it striking when they went to it almost as much as The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
I thought the change from black and white to Technicolor really, really just affected my viewing pleasure. And it made it, not that the black and white sequences were boring me in any way, shape, or form, but once it went to color, I felt much more connected to the movie.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So I did think that was a very good move at that point.
Agreed.
I love the fact that Benchley breaks the fourth wall and acknowledges that now we are in color. You know, he says to the girl, you know, how different she looks in Technicolor, which is completely true. You know, I don't think without that comment, you might initially realize it is the same girl that he was just talking to a scene prior, because she does look completely different in Technicolor. But I love that, you know, he looks at his tie and then he actually opens his outer shirt to look at his inner shirt, which is bright red. And he's like, oh, Technicolor. That's beautiful. It's really, really well done.
And better than signage. You know, I mean, something saying now we're shifting over to Technicolor or something like that. I love the way that it played out. It was a good choice.
Right. And seeing the multiplane cameras just...
I thought it was a good point to break the fourth wall too, because this way, as the viewer, you feel like you're part of the film now.
Definitely.
You were mentioning the multiplane cameras, Scott, and... I think that was, it's one of the pieces of Walt Disney innovation that I love seeing, because I think when you take a look at it, even through the screen, and they show that three-dimensional, it's still breathtaking today. Any of the Disney animated features that made use of that for backgrounds and effects, we were talking about it when we did Snow White, just how beautiful some of those outdoor sequences are. Because of it, it was a striking innovation that I think still there's sequences in there that are unrivaled today.
Oh, yeah.
They did quality-wise. So I was glad that they showed it, because I geeked out during that sequence. And that was a great point to switch it over to Technicolor, because can you imagine if that was in black and white? I mean, we needed to see that sequence with all of its depth of color and everything that they do. That was a beautiful sequence.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're going to see a lot of that stuff when we get to Bambi. The multiplane really shines in that movie, especially like the opening scene and panning through the forest and all that. Speaking of which, you know, Paul was talking about some of the staged stuff and some of the, I forget your words, Paul, but something like some of the hokier aspects of it. I love it, but it's super hokey if you know how these things work. So, you know, Benchley goes up to the top of the multiplane camera, which is essentially like, I think it was like a three-story building type of thing. I mean, it was huge and, you know, very tall. But he goes up to the top and the, whatever the guy's called, animator, whatever his technical term is, the cast member, lets him look down through the multiplane, and we are treated to an actual scene that's completely staged, because that's not how it doesn't move. It doesn't, you know, everything, you know, it's shot one frame at a time. So it doesn't actually move in while you're viewing it. It doesn't pan while you're viewing it. None of that. So all of that is completely staged for the viewer's, you know, enjoyment, but that's not how the thing actually works at all.
We went to a museum yesterday in Cleveland, and it's got four stories, and it's called MoCA. It's in Cleveland. It's more of a local art museum. Cleveland has just a ton of museums, but this one was first time we were there. So we went down, it's by Little Italy. If you're ever in Cleveland, go to the museum district in University Circle and hit Little Italy for lunch, because there's just nothing but amazing restaurants along the way. But we went to this, and I climbed up to the top, and there's this overlook that they were advertising. So I'm like, let me go up there and see that. And it is like this metal panel where you're overlooking down the four floors. I didn't realize I had a heights issue. I do. And so when I'm looking at, so when you're watching this film and looking at this particular sequence, I relate to them as far as climbing up there. Still climbed up, still wanted to look, but the discomfort of it was, I loved the way that they shot that with him, that, and I loved that as he was going up there, the animator or the helper, whoever was up there, was trying to like help him up there, telling him to be careful, because right. You would be doing, like, everything felt very genuine and real, what you'd be doing because of how high that is up there. I thought it was kind of, it was a good, well done sequel, not overdone. It was, I thought, appropriately done.
Agreed. So our next sequence is the ink and paint department, including a Technicolor Technicolor showcasing montage of the paint department. Doris presents a completed cell of the titular character from Bambi. I found this to be interesting. And again, it's a chance for them to show a character that's going to be coming up and get some familiarity with it. To me, it was just more of the same. It's not that it was bad. It definitely belonged in there, but it didn't feel especially informative to me.
I like this sequence. I like it for the music. I like it for the, you know, the showing off basically of Technicolor, you know, all the different colors. I really like the shot of basically, it's almost like a rainbow of the colors coming out of the tubes going into the different receptacles. It's a really beautifully shot sequence. You're right. It's probably not terribly informative and it may run a little long, but I thought it was still a beautiful sequence. And it reminded me of two things, at this time. Well, no, I take that back. Years in the future from this, one of the first attractions at Disneyland was the Rainbow Caverns, which were part of the, the whole Frontierland area. And the, you know, they had a tour back there. And I'm sure that somebody was thinking along the similar lines when they created that whole thing. But also there's a wonderful, I can't help but think it might be a direct nod to this sequence in this film. In the lobby of the Art of Animation Resort at Walt Disney World, the gift shop there is called the Ink and Paint Shop. Mm-hmm. And that has a very similar thing of the colors running much like this. You know, it's supposed to look like the classic ink and paint shop that we see in this film. And I wonder, you know, obviously, it's a reference to that shop, but I wonder if it's also a reference to this sequence of this film.
Disney Channel used to have a show called The Ink and Paint Club, and it ran
right.
It was really good, because if you liked their classic shorts, Silly Symphonies and Donald and Goofy and all that, they ran a rotation of those shorts during that program. And it was for me, I love the shorts. So it's that was a can't miss, but obviously a reference back to the way that all of this was put together originally.
Right. Mm-hmm. And of course, Walt met his wife. You know, she was an ink and paint girl. I don't think she still was by this point. But yeah, originally that's how they met.
The next sequence is the maquette making department, which makes small statues to help the animators envision a character from all sides. Some of the maquettes on display included Aunt Sarah C and M from Lady and the Tramp, and Peter Pan, Captain Hook, Tinkerbell, Mr. Smee, John and Michael Darling. Both films were in development at this time, but would be delayed by World War II and not completed until the 50s, which is what Scott was talking about before. I liked this sequence. I thought it was very cool to see the maquettes. I think they could have done a better job of bringing us in close and seeing some of them a little bit more in detail. I think they kind of rushed some of the shots. I would have liked it if they went a little bit slower and they gave us more of a feeling for the three-dimensional nature of these maquettes and how they could be used by an animator. So this is a sequence which far from bored me. I think it was fascinating and I really wanted to see more, and I wanted to see more close up.
Agreed.
Yeah, agreed. Definitely. There was an interesting note here on the wiki for this movie. It says the employee on duty makes Benchley a maquette of himself, which years later was purchased and owned by Warner Brothers Cartoons director Chuck Jones. I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah.
So Chuck Jones came to own that that bust of Benchley. That's pretty cool.
One other yeah. piece of trivia that I found that I was interesting, because I looked at a few different sites to try and find fun facts and interesting things about this. It was outside when he was first walking to the studio. They have that signpost, Mickey Avenue and Dopey Drive. That was created for this film. When you talk,
I saw that somewhere too. I'm trying to remember. It was I either read that or it might have been on the disc. So I was gonna hold this till later, but. I'll just throw it out here now. I highly, highly, highly recommend, you know, Sean, you were talking about those tin cases. Those are the Walt Disney treasures. Uh-huh. And this film is on disc one of one of the Disney treasures called Behind the Scenes at the Walt Disney Studio. I dug that out last night, intending just to watch The Reluctant Dragon. I watched the entire disc one because basically everything was related to the film. And I think that's where I heard that. But yeah, I mean, that is a famous, famous landmark, that intersection, that corner of Mickey Ave and Dopey Drive that I hope to one day stand at. And it's really cool to find that it exists because of this film. They put it, you know, they created it, they put it in, and then they just left it, and it's still there today. That's really cool.
Leonard Maltin introduces those discs as well.
Yes,
and yeah. if you're a film fan at all, especially if you're a Disney film fan, those tins are well worth seeking out if you don't have them. They're harder to find these days, but you can find them like on eBay purchases, and I'm sure like at Disney conventions and all of that. But they're worth it if you're looking for extras. That's because some of the things on there have not been reprinted elsewhere.
Yeah, it's correct. Yeah. And it's funny because there are certain ones that are really hard to find and really expensive. And then there's other ones that are super common. This one tends to be super common. I got mine last year off of eBay for $18 and change. And it's out there because I'm still hunting several that I don't have. And I see this one come up all the time because I always have to remind myself, nope, I already own that one. But yeah, they are well worth it. And the whole thing with Maltin, that's what won me over to being a Leonard Maltin fan was the Disney treasures. Because up until seeing him and his passion for Disney and those, I never could stand Leonard Maltin. But now I'm actually a fan of him. So,
just as the aside, I've always enjoyed Leonard Maltin's take, and I kind of agree with a lot of his reviews of movies. But the next sequence is, I think, one of the most fascinating ones to watch because it's the storyboard department, where they go through a storyboard of a movie, Baby Weems, which I don't think I've ever seen other than in this storyboard. But I thought it was interesting to see it. And there is some limited animation. It's not that it's not animated at all, but they're showing you the storyboards and how they take that and turn that into a film. And I really thought it was, you know, it made it so much easier to envision how these movies are made. It also features Alan Ladd, who you most people might know as Shane or Cheryl Ladd's father, in this particular sequence. I think he was just playing an employee. I don't think he ever was.
Yeah, that I don't know. I know that is him in the movie, but I don't know if that's, you know, staged, you know, put on, or if he was actually a Disney employee at the time. Because there's a couple other people that you see in the film that I cannot remember by name, but there are a couple other people that you see in the film that actually were Disney employees at the time that, you know, went on to star in other things. One of them being Ernie the cab driver from It's a Wonderful Life is, you know, in a blink and you miss it part in this, and a character actor whose name I've completely forgotten. But when I saw him, I'm like, oh, yeah, I know. I've seen that guy in a million TV shows and movies type of thing. So, yeah, but he actually started as a Disney animator. So
it also features Mount Rushmore before it was done, which was cool because we had.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. So in the sequence, it's George Washington and Abraham Lincoln on there, but Jefferson and Roosevelt are missing because Mount Rushmore wasn't actually done yet.
Oh, I did not know. Oh, that's funny. I figured it was just shorthand for, you know, they were just showing you two of the presidents as shorthand. I didn't realize they weren't. That's really cool.
Yeah. So it was really, I was shocked by that when I looked at it, that was why they were missing from there. I was thinking the same thing you were. I thought it was shorthand at first. And then when I was looking over it, I'm like, to find out that Mount Rushmore wasn't actually done. That's why the sequence was done the way that it was really cool.
That is cool. That is very cool. Yeah, this, honestly, this is the only one of the animated sequences that I really dig in this movie. You know, we'll talk more about the other ones when we get to it. But I like the Baby Weems one. Part of that is, I you know, there's a charm to it. I like the simplicity of it, that it's basically a slightly animated storyboard sequence, which is really an interesting way to, you know, to tell the story and showing the whole thing behind storyboards. It's hard to believe, you know, it's hard to imagine, how the heck did they make movies? How did other studios make movies without storyboards? I mean, that became the accepted way to do it, but if I'm not mistaken, I think that's a Disney invention as well, as storyboarding, you know, cartoons and movies.
This film's credited for actually kicking off some of that.
Right.
Because of the fact that it showed their storyboarding process, so it actually carried over to films. So right. I think you're right. I think it is more of a Disney invention because of animation. They actually were putting out the animation cells for the purpose of kind of fleshing together an animated movie, but then it was carried over into film. So this film actually, it's funny, this film had kicked off a lot of things that weren't in place previously, which I didn't realize. Which I thought was kind of cool. And I agree with you on the Baby Weems sequence. Very cool sequence in what it does.
I mean, some of my favorite books as a kid from being, you know, a fan of Lucas and Spielberg films were the books that came out for, like, Raiders of the Lost Ark and the three Star Wars films that were basically the storyboard telling of the movie. You know, they just put all the storyboards into, it was almost like a coffee table size comic book, essentially telling the movie in, you know, in the original storyboards. And it's fascinating to me to think that there was a time when studios made movies without story. Like, how do you just go by the script and that's it? You there's no, like, how do you see the vision? How do you see the completed movie? Was it just in the director's head? You know, that sort of thing. So it's kind of fascinating in that aspect.
Yeah, I always picture Hitchcock as the storyboard master because he had such a clear vision of what he wanted. And there was very, very little variation at the time of the filming. So he made it very clear, this is the way I want to go. And I would imagine he made very, very big use of storyboards once that became an accepted method of doing so. And right. I wouldn't be surprised at all, even if he didn't fully storyboard out a movie, a sequence, if he had certain images that he said, this is the angle I want, and would present it in a storyboard nature. It might be, you know, and I don't know this, I'm speculating, but it might be something where the process of storyboarding an entire sequence became in vogue after this, but there still might have been individual scenes that, you know, the director would create an image of, or have an image created for it. Because some of the images in Hitchcock movies, Orson Welles movies, you know, any of the, you know, the great directors of the time, a lot of the sequences, the framing of the shot is meant to convey a message beyond what you're hearing. So I can't imagine, like you said, that they're just doing this purely out of their head. I got to think that they have some sort of, it might even just be written out. This is the way I want to do it, as opposed to have it, you know, drawn. But I'm sure they had something to work with. So the next sequence is, it's basically the Goofy cartoon. It's the room of animators, and they're animating the Goofy cartoon, the How to Ride a Horse sequence. And as Sean mentioned earlier, this is something that they would go to often as time went on. And this was the introduction of this particular type of thing. I thought this was okay. I didn't think it was bad. It didn't take away from the movie at all, but it didn't give me the same sense of wonder that the storyboard sequence did.
Yeah, this sequence, I enjoy it for Ward Kimball, and that's pretty much it. I'm not much of a Goofy guy. I like Goofy when he plays with the other characters, but on his own, I've never been a big fan of the Goofy shorts, and this one, I don't know, I find it too long, and it's just kind of annoying to me. But I know Sean's a big Goofy fan, so I'll let him take the rest.
I'm a fan of the how-to movies, and I think that goes back to my childhood, and this goes back to Wonderful World of Disney and all of that. Those shorts, I found them funny, and I still do to this day. I didn't realize, I mean, I do now, but I didn't realize as I was watching when I was younger, the Goofy never speaks in any of these, and the reason why is his voice actor wasn't available during this time. So that's why they put in a narrator, and that you've got a straight narrator who is, you know, kind of talking through the story while Goofy's doing the action. And the narrator didn't know this was for a Goofy cartoon, which was an interesting piece of trivia. They brought him in to narrate this whole thing, and he found out after the fact that they were plopping it over a Goofy cartoon. So he literally was doing it straight without realizing what he was doing it for, which I'm the minority here. I found it effective because I found it very funny. So it's if you're a fan of those Goofy shorts, this was the introduction. Funny, this was 41. I get this How to Ride a Horse is credited for 1950 for being released. So it tells you how long sometimes the studio used to leave concepts in the can beforehand. And I wonder if some of the things that were being showcased, like the stuff we saw later with the Peter Pan stuff, was they threw in there and didn't reference because they didn't know if they were actually going to make them or finish them or go anywhere with them.
Yeah, I'd like to see a really good, like a 4K print or something of like the maquette sequence, and be able to slow it down and really go through it. And I wonder if there are maquettes in there for things that never were realized. Because you're right. I mean, you know, they say no good idea at Disney ever goes to waste, but sometimes those ideas take decades, you know, to come to fruition. You know, Frozen came from an idea for the Ice Queen all the way back in Walt's time. So, you know, yeah, those things, sometimes they have to germinate a long time before they finally get realized.
So at this point in the film, Benchley is finally wrangled by Humphrey, who is the handler who was charged with bringing him to Disney. And has been frustrated this whole time throughout. So he finally brings him, and then we meet Walt, which I found interesting because I was always familiar with the older Walt.
Yeah.
What, 20 or 30 years after this, you know, when he would appear on The Wonderful World of Disney and introduce a sequence or whatever. So that's the way I know him. And to see him, I don't know how old he was at this point, 30 maybe?
40.
40? He looks he looks young for 40.
Yeah.
He was in pretty good shape because he looked younger than 40. But to see, you know, the younger Walt was kind of fun for me. I enjoyed that. And, you know, whatever anybody might ever say about him in real life and what his personality was, who knows? I never met him or whatever. But he always came off to me as Uncle Walt. He really never, there was never a thing when he was on the camera where I didn't find him to be charismatic and enjoyable to see. And this is just adding to that for me, because now seeing him as a younger man, I found to be pretty cool. And then from there, we go to the final animated sequence. But I just wanted to see if you guys had anything to add as far as the sequence of him being brought over.
The way that he introduced Benchley to everybody in the room, and with, like, I already know who you are. He made Benchley feel important. I think it added to your whole, you said I viewed him as Uncle Walt. I thought that sequence did a great job of, if you're trying to talk about an early promo piece, if you're trying to promo Walt as that guy, oh my gosh, did that work. Because he was sitting there, even the way he was sitting, he wasn't sitting with both legs down. Walt was sitting like he was relaxed in the chair, had his leg up. He was very much casual and just part of, like, in with the group. And it was just interesting the way that they handled all that. Like, I wanted to be in there hanging with them, which is, they set up an interesting atmosphere there that I thought for me was effective. As far as if you're trying to make this a glimpse into the studio and wanting people to be in the studio, and even if he's taking a hold of all of Chensky's tchotchkes or Benchley's tchotchkes, as, you know, he's handling one thing over another, trying to get to the book that he never got to. Because I don't think he actually handed the book to Walt, did he? Because I think the feature started when he finally found the book. And at that point in time, Walt was already buried in all this other stuff and they were just started watching the feature. So he never actually got to the point where he handed over the book.
This is probably my most, you know, where I'm most fascinated in the movie is when you get to Walt on so many levels. As Paul said, you know, this is Walt as still a relatively young man. You know, if this was released in 1940, then he was 40 years old, and he still has a youthful vigor. And he would maintain that for a long time. But by the time we got to Walt that everyone knows, you know, Uncle Walt, was about a decade and a half past this. You know, it was the mid-1950s. So, you know, you're looking at a man in his 50s, and, you know, he progressively aged. He put on a lot more weight. So he looked older, a little less energetic, and some, you know, especially toward the very end. But here, what really strikes me is his youth and vigor. And I couldn't help but note that, you know, two things really stood out to me is that, for one, when he sits down and they're going to watch the feature, note how he sits. He almost sits like a teenage girl. He sits very awkwardly and uncomfortably, or it looks uncomfortable. He kind of sits on one leg. And that's what kind of caused my other thought, which was, there was no celebrity with him at all. You know, he greets Benchley as Bob. He introduces him to the boys. And I think he even says, boys, this is, you know, Robert Benchley. And, you know, there's introductions all around. They sit down, they watch the movie. And I'm thinking, this was the head of what was quickly becoming a major studio in Hollywood. If this had been any other studio head, for one, you'd probably had never gotten him on screen, you know, doing this. But even if you had, those other studio heads would probably come off very similar to Bob Hoskins' character in Hollywoodland. You know, they would not come off as affable, you know, and boyish and charming, and, you know, all the things that Walt comes across as in this. They were big shots, or perceived themselves to be big shots. They made and they broke people on a daily basis. And Walt doesn't have any of that in this. And I really like that. You know, he's very human in this. And I like seeing him that way, because this was a really golden time in Disney history for him. He was still riding very high on the success of Snow White. That's why Snow White plays in so much of the music in the background, is that Walt and the studio were still riding that success, that wave. That this entire studio that we see in this tour sequence was built because of the success of Snow White. So it's all related to this. This is almost an extension of Snow White, even if it's just on a subconscious level. But this is also a wonderful, last of the golden age, because as Sean said, things were happening at the same time. You know, things were happening behind the scenes in real world. You've got the strike and the war. So we weren't in the war yet, you know, because this was what, June, I think, of 41 or thereabouts.
June.
We hadn't had Pearl Harbor yet. America was not officially in the war. But those two factors would greatly change Disney, both for the next few years, but also forever in a lot of ways, particularly the strike, because Walt built this studio. Largely out of necessity, but also as a thank you to the people that had created Snow White, that had cemented his success, essentially. He built this beautiful campus style studio and gave these people, you know, all kinds of wonderful amenities that they would not find anywhere else in Hollywood, anywhere else in this business. And what did they do? Many of them turn around and bit the hand that fed them by staging this strike. And Walt never fully recovered from that. People that knew him best said that after the strike, he was a different person and he was a different boss in a lot of ways. He was never as close to his people again. He didn't allow himself to get as close to them again because he felt stung by the strike. And so Walt we're seeing in this is just before all that happens, which I think explains a lot of his exuberance and his youthful vigor and that sort of thing. So, because these events were either playing out or hadn't played out just yet. And then, of course, the war, which was going to affect the entire studio, as we'll see once we get past Bambi. We get more films exactly like this, package features, because the war was wreaking havoc on the studio, both financially and through manpower. But we'll talk about that when we get to the later film. So this is like the last glimpse of a golden age of Disney in a lot of ways. And that's why I really like this sequence.
I wonder if his... I guess, outrage, insult, whatever it might be, is not so much due to the way the employees, not due to the fact that the employees went on strike, but the fact that they actually actively opposed this film when it was released. According to the wiki page, they mentioned that when it was released, strikers picketed the film's premiere with signs that attacked Disney for unfair business practices, low pay, lack of recognition, and favoritism. So I'm wondering if it's not so much the strike as they made it personal.
Oh, yeah, 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 definitely. Yeah, he took the strike personally, very personally.
So the last sequence of the tour through the Disney studios is... the seeing the film The Reluctant Dragon. And while I think this is a perfectly serviceable short, which is what it is, I didn't think it was exceptional. And, you know, it was okay. And it was, you know, it was fine. I read in, I think it was on the wiki page, that that in later days, this has come as something where the dragon itself was presented in a way where you could extrapolate to the fact that he was gay and that he had some kind of the way, you know, just I honestly, I don't like when they have to do that. That was his personality. And that was that. I don't think the cartoon dragon needed to have a sexual preference. Right. That's the thing. Like, I feel like sometimes we have to read too much into this. His personality was that, you know, that, what's his name? Joe Besser, if you remember him from the Abbott and Costello show with the Three Stooges, you know, when he said, "Ooh, I'll give you such a pinch," that guy. Yeah. And find it amusing, and that's all. I don't feel like you have to read more into it than that.
He was enthusiastic about his art. He was enthusiastic about his poetry. Was not remotely enthusiastic or passionate about fighting. So, and you see that with his enthusiasm. He actually was ready to walk away from them anytime fighting came up. But man, if somebody talked about a poem or his verse or their own verse, he was all back in on the whole thing. And honestly, when I found it charming that he got enthusiastic about the idea of them putting on a play with the way that the fight was going to be. It wasn't actually going to be a fight. It was going to be a scripted play. That was the only way to get him involved in the whole doggone thing. And it was intriguing that that was the case. I could see why people are going there, but I'm like, really? That's what you got out of this? I'm like, that's your issue? I don't get it. I don't see it in this one.
Yeah, this honestly, this is my least favorite segment of the entire film. And I'm not sure why. I think it is the dragon's personality. I get what they were going for, but I find him, he reminds me of like Trelane from Star Trek, who I always found kind of foppish and annoying as well. So it's that sort of thing. It has its moments. It's trying hard to be charming, but I don't know. It just goes on a little bit long, and I'm not really a fan of this animation style. I'm not sure who the chief animators were on this sequence, but it's just not my preferred animation style. I think I understand what they were going for, but for me personally, it didn't quite come off. I think maybe a little more serious approach and maybe a little more, I don't know, something different in the animation that I can't quite put my finger on. But I do find it interesting that they changed up the knight. Because I guess according to the original story, it's actually Saint George, which would have been kind of interesting, because I'm pretty sure somewhere in Epcot, there's a couple of different depictions of knights slaying dragons around the World Showcase in Epcot, and I'm pretty sure one of them is Saint George slaying the dragon. So it would have been interesting to, you know, as some sort of connection with this film, I guess, but they did change it to Sir Giles. Now, Sir Giles is kind of fun. He's kind of an interesting character. He reminds me of, I can't remember the guy's name, in the old Jay Ward cartoons, the guy who was the World Explorer guy. You know who I'm talking about?
Commander McBrigg.
Yeah. He kind of sort of, he seems like he's kind of cut from the same cloth type of thing. But yeah, that's about all I got. This is where the film seriously kind of, it kind of peters out for me.
Sir Giles reminded my wife of one of the characters from Cinderella.
Yes. Well, it's funny you say that, because the song that he's singing when he was in the bath sounds very much like the scump song that one of the fathers in Cinderella is singing as well. Or is that? Is that Snow White? Or I mean, Cinderella, with the two fathers, like one's the skinny king and one's the fat king. Is that Cinderella? Now I'm confusing my princess movies, but I think, but you know, there's that song that they sing, scomp, scomps, blah, 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 blah. I forget the words to it, but it sounds very similar to that song.
So the last sequence in the film is Benchley's driving home and his wife is busting his chops for failing to sell the movie, and he answers Fooey in Donald Duck's voice to close out the film. And it's just, you know, it's fine. It's just a little closing to it. No great shakes, but it's better than just having, you know, the end.
It's, as I said earlier, one of my issues I have with this is I would have loved a closing sequence that somehow the short was made because she let Walt know about his idea or something like that ahead of time, and she was surprising him. I just felt like it was the closing sequence felt very rushed to me, and I felt like there was an opportunity there to tie this whole thing up in a nice, neat bow. And I don't hate it. It just was kind of I would have liked to seen something a little bit more from that as far as how they knew to make the reluctant dragon was somehow linked to the two of them. But that would have been my only wish other than that. But I think to the point of what Scott said earlier, I think you're both in agreement on the reluctant dragon short. I thought the shirt was okay. Like you said, Paul, it was serviceable. I kind of felt the same way about the short, but I liked the Benchley sequences overall a great deal. So I would have, yeah. I think I kind of wanted that to tie up more because I was enjoying so much the Benchley journey, far more than anything else.
Yeah, I had to look it up. The Scump song was Sleeping Beauty. Sleeping Beauty, not Cinderella. Yeah, it was the two kings drinking song.
Okay.
Makes sense.
I guess we'll wrap up. To me, this was enjoyable. I didn't know this movie even existed until recently. It was a nice little tour through the Disney studios. I don't really have any particular negatives to give it, but on the other hand, I don't see it as something that I would seek out to watch again. If I was flipping through the channels and on Disney they were showing a sequence that I was interested in, I might stop on it. I probably wouldn't stay through the whole movie again. So, you know, it was good. It was worth seeing at least once. I don't know that it's a repeat viewing type movie, but I'm glad I watched it and I enjoyed the experience of watching it. So for that reason, I would put it at a high Jaws 3. It's a perfectly enjoyable experience, and I wouldn't hesitate to tell anybody interested in animation and filmmaking that this is a good one to watch. But I also, again, I don't think this is like a classic by any stretch of the imagination.
So I agree with everything about your rating, and I think for people, if you're not a huge Disney history fan, you probably fall in that category for this film. I love the history aspect of this one. It really struck me. I'm putting it at a low Jaws 2. I agree with you on the rewatchability. I'm probably going to watch it again because of all the Easter eggs and things in it that I really dug. And so that kind of made it work for me on that, and that's why I'm a low Jaws 2. But I would say if you're a Disney fan and you like the history and you've never seen this, you should. And I think you're going to find a lot charming in it with the Easter eggs that are in it that will give you a little extra bonus. So that's where I think my additional rating comes from on this one as far as what your mileage is. I dig the old school stuff.
Yeah, I'm with Paul on this one. This one's definitely a Jaws 3 for me. I'm fascinated by the history stuff. I love most of the stuff with Benchley in the studio. I find fascinating, but that's me as a Disney history nerd. I think if you're just Joe average, you know, you enjoy Disney, but you're not a hardcore, you know, buff that needs to know all the behind the scenes stuff, and you know, if you have no idea who Ward Kimball is or something like that, then you're probably going to be, frankly, bored with this one. Your kids will definitely not sit through the whole thing. They might really enjoy the animated stuff. I mean, little kids would probably love the Reluctant Dragon cartoon at the end of the feature, but getting them to it might be tough. You know, and any movie that, you know, I find myself checking my watch when it's only 74 minutes long, or, you know, in the case of Clara Cluck, having to mute or fast forward, and that's never a good sign. So, like I say, I enjoy this one. It's going to be a while before I dig it back out and give it a rewatch, but I'm glad to have rewatched it again because, The stuff that fascinates truly fascinates, but the stuff that drags or bores, that's a slog. So yeah, this one's a very uneven film in that regard. So I would say, you know, if you're interested in the history stuff, watch the live action stuff. If you're history, you know, if you're more interested in the cartoons or your kids want to watch the cartoon stuff. And, you know, so there's a little bit of everything, you know, something for everybody. But yeah, I think that there's a reason why even hardcore, you know, many hardcore Disney fans have never heard of this one, because it just kind of falls through the cracks. It's a hard to define movie because it's not one of the animated classics, but it's not one of the live action films either. It's a weird hybrid in between.
So I guess that'll do it for The Reluctant Dragon. And this was a much lengthier conversation than I anticipated when I was watching the movie. And I'm glad for that. I think we got a lot of meat on the bone. Next time out for this particular project, we're going to hit Dumbo. So, you know, that's pretty readily available if anybody wants to watch it in advance. In the meanwhile, Scott, thanks for joining us today. And thank you to everybody who's listening to us today. And we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
So while you were shilly-shallying, they made the picture. I never knew it to fail. In all the years I've known you, you've always been too late. Really, Robert, I can't understand why you're forever letting these opportunities slip through your fingers. Anyone else would have thought of it in time, months ago. But you... Well, why don't you say something?